Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome back. Hi, I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, sorry.
Therapist Kelly.
It's good to see you.
It's good to see you too, as always.
I know.
How are you doing?
So, it's weird. I'm kind of sad. My neighbor's leaving today.
And
I'm
like, the good one.
The good one.
I hope the bad one's never listening because they'll know.
I always think about that. I always think about that. It's so funny, but I doubt it.
But
yes, I'm like so sad. And like, I saw the moving van and I was like, started to like well up a little bit.
Aww.
So I said goodbye, and you know, I'm excited for him, and you know, he's gonna have a great new adventure, but I'm kind of scared. And I think they're gonna like, there's not a complete tear down, but they're definitely gonna do a lot of renovation, and then they might flip it. So I feel like I don't know what's in store. It's kind of weird. It's a weird feeling.
So they haven't sold it to anybody yet.
They did
sell it. So have you met the new neighbors?
No, I haven't met her.
No idea.
But they keep calling it an investment.
Oh.
And so I have a feeling that they're just, you know, they're
right.
going to do their stuff and goodbye. So, yeah, so I'm kind of sad. It's like a weird feeling. I don't know. I guess maybe because it's like I finally kind of felt secure and it was great to have that. And I really liked him. And now I'm like, oh, my God, I'm not going to have that.
I think there is a great deal of comfort and security in knowing that you have a cool neighbor.
Yes.
I mean, I love my neighbors. They are amazing. And anytime like one of the neighbors nearby, because we have a little cul-de-sac, is moving or he's questioning who is going to come in, you know?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Because there's nothing worse than having a crazy neighbor. You know, I've had a crazy tenant. He wasn't my neighbor, but I had a house that I owned in Encino. And when I moved into another place, I kept it and rented it out.
Uh-huh.
This guy was nuts. The neighbors were calling me, telling me he flips on the light switches in the middle of the night. And
oh my God.
They didn't know if he was like maybe making crystal meth in the house. I mean, he was so bizarre. I had to take down a tree because it was the roots were pushing up against the side of the house. And he sent me a scathing email of about 7 pages long, shouting, you know, all in bold, cap letters. I only accepted this house because of that tree. If you're going to tear the tree down and you call yourself the author of healing the sensitive heart, what kind of heart do you have? And he went going on and on. And this was the first week of him moving in and he had a year lease. Oh, it was insane.
I feel like you encounter more crazy people than I know. And it's
well,
so perfect for
our
topic
today. Yes.
Exactly. But that's incredible. Wow.
I know. So I'm going to keep my fingers crossed for you. Maybe, though, they're going to make this such a beautiful home and there's going to be a lovely family that's going to move in.
That's
and
what
your
I was
boys
thinking.
Will have playmates and we can hope.
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely.
So what's going on with you? Anything?
You know, I'm good. The highlight of my weekend, I was like a normal person this weekend. Instead of like just doing wild and crazy things, I literally just sort of took everything out of the cabinets in my kitchen and reorganized all of it.
So isn't it funny how it's like we kind of make our own like craziness because it's like it's calm and it's like, let me create chaos.
You know, but it's like, you know, when you move in and it's been 7 years, you know, I've always moved things around and stuff like that, but never really organized it the way it would be really user friendly.
Yeah.
And now everything is stacked properly and it's like I'm a perfect OCD right now.
I love it.
So that's it. So if anybody would like to give us a call, please do so at 323-203-0815. Again, 323-203-0815. We'll give thanks to our sponsor, Kim Gold, who has been so supportive of our show, and we just adore her. And she's the author of Gold Standard, How to Rock the World and Run an Empire. So, wow, we had an incredible show last week. That was really special.
I loved it. I can't stop thinking about it. Last week we had the famed 3T, otherwise known as Tito Jackson's sons and nephews of famed Jackson 5, Taj, Terrell, and TJ.
They're so cute.
We were obsessed with them. And I was telling my husband like how I really loved what they stood for. Like I love their character. I just thought they were so classy, kind, loving, gentle. I mean, I feel like we could have done like a 2-hour show with them.
I know. Such amazing hearts. They were just precious. I couldn't believe how old they were. I actually thought that they were in their 20s, maybe early 30s. It was
for sure
striking.
Well, it was funny because when I saw one of the shows, I thought for sure TJ, the youngest, I could have sworn he was like a teenager. I'm not even kidding. Like maybe 20. And then when he said his age, I was like, wait, what? I couldn't believe it.
Anyway, so, completely adorable. And yes, if you missed that show, please go tune in. That was last week, and it was very special. Yeah. This week, this is very exciting for me. This is a gentleman that I met years ago when I was first writing my very first book, and he was just so sweet and kind to me to take the time, because he's very well known and very famous, to take the time to actually help me out and give me some tips and tools and things to do about writing. So I'm very excited today. We have Dr. Mark Goulston, the author of Talking to Crazy, joining us. Dr. Mark is a shrink to fit, whose many talents include being a suicide interventionist, death and dying practitioner, UCLA professor of psychiatry for more than 25 years. Get a load of this, Kelly. It's amazing. Oh, FBI and police hostage negotiation trainer, an international speaker, advisor, and confidant to CEOs and founders, and advisor to the prosecution in the O.J. Simpson criminal trial, and inventor of recoupling therapy, which focuses on helping divorced couples get back together and successfully remarry their ex-spouse. It's like, wow, could anybody have more credentials?
Oh my gosh, this is incredible.
He's also the author of 7 books, including the bestseller Get Out of Your Own Way and Just Listen, Discover the Secret of Getting Through to Absolutely Anyone. And today he's with us to talk to us about talking to crazy, how to deal with the irrational and impossible people in your life. Welcome to our show, Dr. Mark.
Are you there?
Well, I can hardly wait to hear from this guy.
Who is he? How could he ever even have time to do this show today? He must be an imposter.
He sounds like a pathological liar to me.
I have so many questions. Oh, my God. Even just that beginning, I have questions about. Wow. So, holy cow. Okay, well, first of all, I mean, we want to obviously get to you and your book and your questions, but it was interesting. I had no idea about the advisor to the prosecution, the O.J. Simpson trial. And I don't know if you watched the latest FX series about O.J., because I've gotten so into it. I finished it and it was fantastic, but I'm just curious.
I didn't watch it. I had mixed feelings about that, but, you know, I've become friends with Gil Garcetti, who apparently spoke out on it actually yesterday, that he didn't choose Marcia Clark as his first choice. And I can remember that. And actually, there was another prosecutor who became ill, who was the lead prosecutor, and he was replaced by the black prosecutor, Christopher Dart. Uh-huh. So I was there through that, and I kind of watched that.
Wow.
It was really an amazing circus, the whole thing.
I bet.
And,
that's incredible. So you were an advisor in what way? I'm just curious, like, what did you do exactly?
Well, what happened is I had met Garcetti, Gil Garcetti. He's the father of the mayor. And I sent him an email, and I said, I don't really know that much about trials or even juries. I know something about people. And I said, if I was asking black jurors, if I was interviewing them, one of the things I would ask them is, have you ever changed your mind about the way you feel about someone? Because if they hadn't changed their mind about an abusive dad, they're not going to change their mind about O.J. Simpson. Mm. And also, if you did change your mind, what caused you to change your mind? Because if it was emotional stuff, you would have an emotional case. And if it was facts that caused people to change their mind, then have a factual case. And he came back and he said, you know, I spoke with Barsha and the other prosecutor, and as soon as he said this, we looked at each other and we said, we never would have thought of that, ever. And as soon as you said it, it was obvious. And so one of my skills, which actually I honed being a suicide specialist, is I seem to be able to go into their minds and look at the world through their eyes. So what I did is I would go to the trial. I was probably there about 30 days, and I would just give them input and suggestions and observations for what would convince the jury of this, or what would do something. So one of the tips that they did use was in the closing argument. This is how I think. I said, you know, after a jury goes into deliberation and you want to affect their decision making, how would you do that? And what dawned on me is you'd want to haunt them. Because when they're no longer seeing you, you'd want to haunt them. And I thought, what would be haunting? And by that time, nobody wanted to hear from Marcia Clark or Chris Darden. People didn't mind Johnny Cochran because his voice at least was melodic, and they weren't going to hear from O.J. Simpson. So I said, in your closing argument, play the tape of Nicole Brown Simpson identifying O.J. Simpson trying to break into her townhouse, because leave the jury with a lasting impression, the voice of the murder victim naming the person that murdered her. Yeah.
Wow.
That was one of the tips of mine they didn't use. They did use. One they didn't use was, this is when, remember when the DNA evidence came out?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. And so I said, you know, this DNA is above everybody's pay grade. Nobody understands this stuff. Even educated people didn't understand. I said, hold up a Coca-Cola can and show people the barcode on a Coca-Cola can, because you trust the barcode more than you trust a cashier at Ralph's, and then make links in people's minds and say, what does that barcode look like? So what would happen is I seem to be able to look at the trial from anybody's point of view. In fact, mm-hmm. I could close my eyes for 20 seconds, and when I open them, I could look at it from anybody's point of view in the courtroom, which is sort of how I've conducted my career as a therapist and a hostage negotiation trainer, is being able to look at the world through someone else's eyes. And it actually started because I was sort of a heavyweight suicide interventionist, and one of my first mentors actually started the suicide prevention centers in Washington and L.A., and he used to refer me still suicidal patients who needed to be discharged from UCLA, but they weren't acutely suicidal. You just couldn't keep them there forever.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And so my wife will tell people, you know, he never got to sit through a movie for about 10 years because I'd always be getting beat. Mm. But I didn't hospitalize people. I got them when they came out of the hospital. And there was one story that will give you a sense of where I learned all this, to see things from people's inside out. What happened is I was moonlighting at a state hospital to make some extra money, and so I hadn't slept for a couple days, and I'm seeing this woman we will call Nancy, and she'd made four attempts prior to my seeing her, and she'd been in the hospital before being discharged to see me, and she didn't really make eye contact. She wasn't catatonic, but she didn't really make eye contact. And I didn't think I was helping her, except she would come in two or three times a week, not say much. And that was the longest she'd gone. I was seeing her for 6 months. That was the longest she'd gone without a suicide attempt or hospitalization. And then I'd been up, as I said, 2 days moonlighting, and as I was seated with her, and she's not looking at me, suddenly all the color in the room turned to black and white. So I'm looking out, and the room's black and white. And then it started to just kind of like melt into this cold gray, and I thought I was having a stroke or a seizure, so I did I'm a medical doctor, so I did a neurologic exam on myself, and I'm tapping my knees, and I'm tapping, I'm looking at my fingers, and it wasn't rude, because she never made eye contact, and I said, I'm not having a stroke or a seizure, I think I am seeing the world through her eyes.
Wow.
And feel.
That's incredible.
And so, yeah, it gets even more, and so I'm sleep deprived, and so when you're sleep deprived, you not only have these strange experiences, but you blurt out things. And so this is what I said to her. I said, Nancy, I didn't know it was so bad, and I can't help you kill yourself, but if you do, I will still think well of you. I will miss you, and maybe I'll understand why you had to get out of the pain. And I thought to myself, did I think that or did I say that?
Oh.
And then I said, dang, I just gave her permission. And that was the first time she made eye contact with me. And then I got a little paranoid. She looked at me and I said, what are you thinking? I thought she was going to say, thanks for letting me do it. I'm overdue.
Right.
And I said, what are you thinking? And she stared right into my eyes. And I realized that I had sort of connected with her from what I was seeing. And she said, if you can really understand why I might have to kill myself to get out of this pain, maybe I won't need to. And then she smiled, and she gave up her suicidality.
That's beautiful.
Wow, she wanted to feel understood.
Yeah, seen.
Yes.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And, And I have a personal mission. My personal mission is called Healing the World One Conversation at a Time. And what I want to help people to do is, if you listen into people, so I listened into Nancy. I didn't know I was doing it, but I listened into her. And if you do that with people, they will open up to you. If you can look into people's eyes and know there's always something else going on underneath what they're saying, and if the look in your eyes, looking in their eyes, is you're only there to help them and alleviate pain, lessen suffering, then if you just concentrate and look into their eyes and say, what's really going on? Yeah, I understand what you just said, but what's really going on? Mm-hmm. I am telling you that if you do that and repeat it 4 times, mm-hmm. and you're convinced that there's something way down deep, they'll reveal it to you. One of my closest friends ran the Marines in the 90s, and we did a transition program for returning Marines. And the best experience of it all was when Marines said we got to spend an hour and a half one-on-one with General Marty Steele. And I said, what did you talk about to these Marines? Mm-hmm. And he is someone who has a different different Myers-Briggs than every other Marine, because he listens into people, and he would say, Marine, what's going on? Because that's how they call each other. You're a Marine for life. And they'd say, well, you know, sir, it's kind of difficult transitioning. And he'd say, but what's really going on, Marie? Well, my wife and I are getting into these arguments. And he'd say it about 4 or 5 times, and the 5th time, he said they would look, and he would look right into their eyes, and they said, I saw and did awful things, sir, and when I close my eyes, I see them more clearly, so I don't close my eyes much, sir. And what he said to them is, war isn't pretty, but it's necessary, and I'm giving you a direct order to put that aside. All of us Marines have had that experience, and you need to put that aside to enjoy your life and your family. And he got letters and letters from spouses saying, I don't know if you knew it, General Steele, but you saved my husband's life.
Wow. Yeah. Aww.
So thank you for letting me, you know, for a guy who wrote a book on listening, you can't shut me up. But those are beautiful stories.
But
I think it's possible for us to do that.
Yes.
That is wonderful. Oh, thank you. I'm so touched.
Me too.
I don't have a voice anymore.
I know. It's really interesting.
I know. But we do have lots of questions for you about your book, too. So should we move toward that?
Yeah. Well, let's make the transition from just listen to talking to crazy, because just listen, and I'm humbled by how well it became the top book on listening in the world, and I've spoken around the world on listening. But it's about how do you listen into people. But there were 2 chapters that people liked more than other chapters. One was, I think it was called Steering Clear of Toxic People. This is in the Just Listen book.
Okay.
And the other one was How to Move Yourself from OF to OK. So it's a way of calming yourself down. And that got so much interest that I decided to write an entire book on talking to crazy. So this, we're not talking about mental illness here. We're talking about people who drive you crazy.
Yeah. Sure.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I've taken a lot of heat from the mental health profession. They say, Dr. Goulston, we got so much stigma, and you're a psychiatrist, and you write a book called Talking to Crazy? How could you? And here's my passive-aggressive response, which I have to share with you. I say, well, if we called it something else, it wouldn't grab people. So what I'm hoping is that people will read it, and they will learn actually how to be empathic and effective. And by the way, I think all the jargon that the mental health profession uses really serves the mental health professional more than it serves the patient.
Absolutely right. Agree.
And I think some of the, you use the term borderline personality with another person. I mean, even if it's true, there is no way they can take that as non-judgmental or not condescending.
Right.
But in talking to crazy is about leaning into people's craziness, not just listening, but leaning in. And the analogy is if a dog bites your arm, you push your arm into the dog's throat and it will release it. If you try to pull it away, it'll dig its teeth in. And people who drive you crazy, that's exactly what they do.
So
if you lean into it, they'll release.
Oh, I like that.
Really interesting. And I, you know, when I read that in your book, I was thinking, oh my God, that's so right. And it's so hard to do, but it's right. So it's like you got to let your own feelings about it, you know, you put your own pride aside, but then it'll be helpful in the long run. So I really appreciate that.
And here's a tip you can take to the home or the bank. So a common situation that we hear about, our parents who are on their teenager's back about doing homework, and the teenagers push back. So, you know anybody like that?
My son? Yeah.
Just about every teenager. Yeah, exactly. And
okay, so do either of you have a son who is, you know, when you nag them, they're not particularly receptive?
Well, I have a grown daughter now. Kelly has not gone through adolescence yet, but she does.
But I'm experiencing this, so I can't even imagine.
She's going through mini adolescence, yes, with her 6-year-old and her 3-year-old.
Exactly.
So, so here's what you do. There's something, and you may be aware of the term. Hold on, I'm rejecting another call. This is what happens when we do.
It's okay. I mean, of us.
Are we still good?
We're still good? Yes.
Okay. I just sent someone from Michigan back to Michigan. So, so there's something called mediated catharsis, and that's where you verbalize the negative thing that another person might want to tell you, and when they tell you it on their own, you get all angry or defensive. So let's say it's a teenager that doesn't want to do their homework.
Okay.
Or doesn't want to, and every time you bring it up, it doesn't really motivate them, makes them more frustrated. So what you do is you go into their room, and tone, I think you'll both agree, tone is very important in communication. Tone is more important than content.
Absolutely.
So it's not just the words, it's how you say it. So you go into your teenager's room, and this is the tone. It's firm but not hostile. You could say, I get something I'd like you to try. And they'll say, what? I'll say, just humor me. There's something I'd like you to try. And then what you do is you look them straight in the eye and you say, I want you to say this exactly to me, and try and lean into it if you can feel it. And then you look into their eyes and say this to me, Mom, get off my back already. You're just making things worse. Leave me the F alone. And what will happen is your kid's going to say, what? Say, yeah, you know, just repeat exactly that and see if you can say it with some feeling. And they'll start to get giddy. And you have me, you can say, wait a minute, you were holding back. Come on. And what's going to happen is you're not going to get defensive because you're inviting them to say it as opposed to they're saying it on their own. And the reason they'll get giddy is because inside a lot of teenagers is the desire to not resent their parents.
Yes.
I remember one teenager said to a parent, when I was seeing them, she said to her mother, you know, the only thing I hate more than you is hating you. I hate hating you.
Yeah.
But you drive me crazy. Mm-hmm. But I hate hating you. And so when you give them the chance, that's why it's called a mediated catharsis. When you give them the chance to verbalize something that would normally lead to an argument, they get giddy because they get relief. And then you keep doing it until they're finally saying it and you get a feeling it was real and you can say, I think you nailed it. Dinner in an hour.
Yeah, it's kind of like a paradoxical intervention. Yes. You're sort of giving your teenager permission to be resistant because that's what they are anyway, and to let you know about it without them having to buffer it. I like it.
And validating it's okay for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so you're leaning into it, and when you're leaning into it, it's disarming.
Yeah,
absolutely. And that's all we really want to be with our loved ones, is to try to become non-defensive and be permissive for people to really share what's going on. But so many people are so guarded and defensive because they're so insecure, they have so much shame, they don't have self-esteem, they're fearful. So what do you suggest with people like that, Dr. Mark?
Well, I think a lot of people are guarded because they anticipate us being judgmental. And what a lot of parents will say is, I'm somewhat judgmental, but what I always am is impatient because I'm just rushed. I'm managing so many things that I just want to get through this so I can get to the next thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But what happens is that other person will project on you, you're just wanting to get things done with your being judgmental, and maybe you're being judgmental, you're saying this is taking too long. And I coach a lot of executive women on how to make it in the C-suite and how to make it in a man's world without becoming the B-word.
Mm-hmm.
And so recently I was talking to one woman, and this is very common for women who are the only women in, say, an executive team. And they'll go in there, and the boys will be bantering. And what happens is the boys resent the woman because they think she's condescending and she's judging them.
Mm-hmm.
And in reality, at least most of the good women I know, they say, I'm not judgmental. I know boys will be boys. Mm-hmm. It's just that I have better things to do than wait the 15 minutes till they get through it and we get started. I could have made 4 calls. And so this was the tip, sort of leaning into the craziness. What she said at the next meeting, she said, hey, can I get here 15 minutes after the meeting starts? And then if I'm a little behind when we start dealing with business, someone will fill me in. Because, first of all, I have other things I can get done during the first sort of 15-minute kind of warm-up where you're kind of, you know, bantering with each other. And I see how bantering is just part of what you need to do. And I think I'm inhibiting that bantering anyway. So how about if I show up, you know, 15 minutes after the allotted time, and we'll get started that way, because I don't hold it against you that you need to go through that.
Mm-hmm.
I just have other things to do. And so it was very disarming.
Yeah, I can see that.
Can you see how that would make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Completely.
Yeah. I'm really excited to hear about what goes on in our brains and minds when somebody's doing something that's making us crazy.
Yeah, and I apologize for those rings, but you know, you can hear me around them. I'm a very passionate neuroscientist, and so what happens is, one of the things that all crazy-making people do, and this could be the bullies, this could be the whiners, this could be the shutdown, sullen husbands, it could be any of those things, is they push us from frustration into anger, and anger into we're appalled with them.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they do that, I like to think of the brain as having 3 brains. We have an upper brain, which is our rational brain. That's our human brain. That's been around 250,000 years. Our middle brain is our emotional brain. That's our mammalian brain, and that's been around 65 million years. And then our lower brain is our reptile fight-or-flight brain. But the key thing is that middle brain, that emotional brain. And inside our middle brain is something called an amygdala.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a fellow who invented the field of emotional intelligence named Dan Goldman. And he coined the term amygdala hijack. And so what happens with all difficult people is they push us from frustration to anger to maybe even rage. And if we're not comfortable with being enraged, what happens is we try to put a lid on it because the next thing they say, we're going to want to rip their throat up.
I know.
And when we're off balance, that's when they go for the jugular. So can I tell you a story that's better than any story I've told you so far?
Please.
It was one day, you may not know where you were on September 6, 1995, but I'll refresh your memory. That was the day that Detective Mark Furman took the Fifth Amendment to say that he didn't want to incriminate himself. And for people listening who don't remember the OJ trial, Detective Mark Furman was a detective who basically helped the prosecution lose the trial because during the trial, he said he'd never said the N-word, and the N word is this awful word. And then at the end, tapes revealed that he had. So on the day that he took the Fifth Amendment, because he didn't want to incriminate himself, I was sequestered in the top floor of the criminal courts building because F. Lee Bailey had accused me of medicating him, brainwashing him, and coaching him during the cross-examination in which he just came off as like John Wayne. And so I'm there, and I don't know what's going on. I didn't know that he took the Fifth Amendment, and so I'm up there. And it really is true. Your life flashes before your eyes. I'm thinking, what the heck am I doing here? And one thing about the way my mind works is I always put myself in very difficult situations. And just when I'm about to panic, instead of panicking, I get smart. I mean, I keep doing this, so I know I'm going to, one day I'm going to end up having a massive stroke and heart attack and have a huge smile on my face because I will have discovered the answer to meaning of life. But that's what I do. I push myself into impossible situations. So that's what was happening to me. I was starting to get a little panicky. It's 5 p.m. And then I figured out F. Lee Bailey. And I figured that what he would do is he'd charm me, he'd frustrate me, he'd anger me, and then he'd push me into my rage. Mm-hmm. And so I had him so hardwired that when he came in, he sits down across the table from me, and Bill Hodgman, who was the prosecutor who was working on the trial before Christopher Darden, was kind of my chaperone, and someone from Johnny Cochran's office was with F. Lee Bailey. And so F. Lee Bailey starts charming, and then charming me, and he says, you know, Dr. Goldstone, we don't know exactly what you do here. We just know you've been here at various times during the trial, and we need to ask you some things. Now, one of the things I've learned to do is I've learned to look into people's eyes in a very non-threatening but intent way. So I can hold on to people's eyes, and I've used that when I've dealt with depressed and suicidal people, going back to Nancy, and I hold on to their eyes, and what I'm saying with my eyes is you're going to walk out of being suicidal. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You're going to walk out and get out of this. So it's a very protective but non-intimidating, but I'm just holding on to his eyes. And so no one else can see that. And I'm holding on to his eyes the whole time. And what I also realized, I got an insight when people use innuendo. So when he said, Dr. Goldstone, we don't know what you're doing. We understand you've been here. Normally, when someone uses innuendo, you go, uh-huh. And what I realize is when people use innuendo, it's like they put a hook in your throat and they're pulling you in for the kill.
Okay.
So instead of going, uh-huh, I kept staring at his eyes, and every time I would have said, uh-huh, I blinked my eyes, but I kept looking at him, you know, in this calm, open, but I've got his eyes, you know, on my eyes. And so what happens is he's going on for about 4 minutes, and then Bill Hodgman says to me, Mark, you haven't said anything. Meaning I didn't say aha. I didn't say anything. I just blinked when I would normally say aha. And I looked at Bill and I said, he hasn't asked me a question. Mm-hmm. And then I looked back at F. Lee Bailey, who kind of flinched a little bit. And I think he might have thought there's more to this guy than I thought. Mm-hmm. And so then he starts upping his what he's saying to me or asking me. And just like in the trial, when he confronted Furman and said, so are you saying you never said the N-word? What he says to me, he reaches that point where he says, so you're here to tell us that you never medicated, you never coached, you never in any way prepared Detective Furman for any of his testimony, and he was being real hostile. So if you can picture, it's like a replay of what he did with Furman.
Yeah.
And so he finishes it, and everyone in the room, I can almost feel it with the two of you, they're waiting for what I'm going to say, and I'm holding on to Bailey's eyes, and I count to seven, and I see everyone wants to know what I'm going to say. And so I go like that. It was like the E.F. Hutton commercial, and then I count to seven again.
Can I guess what you ended up saying?
Pardon?
Can I guess what you ended up saying?
Have you read it before? Or
no,
did you,
no. I'm just guessing. I would say, you still haven't asked me a question. Nope. Got it wrong.
That would have worked. What I said to him is, my mind wandered the last 5 minutes. Could you repeat everything you said?
Oh, my God. You must have been so angry.
Oh, no, he said, what? I said, yeah, you know, my mind, because I had him hardwired. I said, you know, my mind wandered. I was, you know, it's 7 p.m. They may have locked the parking lot. I don't know if I'm going to get my car out. You know, I'm really sorry about that. Could you repeat everything you know, you said last 5 minutes? Sorry about that.
That's hysterical.
And he looked. Oh, yeah. No, and so he looked at Carl Douglas with a look that said, what did I say? Because what happens is people who drive us crazy, one of the reasons they do that is to hide the fact that they don't have substance on their side. So if they can provoke us so that we just want to get away from them or else we're going to kill them, they don't risk having their lack of substance suddenly being shown in the you know, light of day. And so he basically, at that point, there was nothing he really had to say because
right.
I hadn't done anything wrong.
Sure.
And because I'm a little, when I'm immature and I give this talk, and when people say, you know, basically when people ask me about Detective Mark Furman, I say, I never laid a bloody glove on the guy. But, you know.
That's so funny.
Anyway.
Wow.
So anyway, Bailey, but what happened is that's the principle of knowing that all difficult people are going to go in and they're going to try to provoke you. And so what's the tip to take away? Now, the tip to take away is never expect them not to act that way. So identify all the people that are crazy-making.
Okay.
And always expect that somewhere in the conversation they're going to do something to try to tick you off and get you off the scent of, you know, holding them accountable, because really what you want to do is you want to rip their throat out.
Right.
And so hold a little bit of yourself back, and then when they act that way, you can say something. Can you repeat what you just said? Or you can say, you know, could you say that to me kind of in a normal voice? Because, you know, when you say it the way you did, I tend to react. When I react, I stop thinking. So can you run that by me in a normal voice? Or you can look at them and then go, huh? So those are for the people who are the crazy-making people who invade our space. And if we have some time, we'll talk about the ones who are passive-aggressive, the ones who are shut down. You can't pull them out of their shell. Those can make us crazy also.
One more question, though, about what you were just talking about. Do you think that most of those people who are crazy-making are consciously doing what you're suggesting, or is there a mixed bag? There's some people who are more consciously doing that, like sociopaths and manipulators, et cetera, and others who are just, they're traumatized, they're reenacting their trauma over and over again, like they can't expect
yes.
to be around people who aren't going to be upset with them and angry with them.
I think you hit the nail on the head. The more conscious they are, the more sociopathic they are.
Okay.
Ah, interesting.
But the majority of them, I think it's just a knee-jerk response for how they can keep from being controlled. And a lot of time what it is they're trying to keep other people off the scent of their being incompetent. So if you can get someone really upset,
uh-huh.
that person is going to spend their energy trying to calm themselves down rather than continuing, you know, to ask you questions that might reveal that you haven't done something you're supposed to do.
So avoidance of their responsibility, accountability,
sure.
Lack of competency, all those would be the underlying reasons to create that sort of knee-jerk reaction.
Right. And also, by the way, you brought up something that, in terms of people's past, sometimes what's happened is they grew up and they watched, they were either controlled or belittled or bullied by a parent, or they watched one parent do it to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so often what you learn is, well, when I get to be an adult, I'm not going to let anyone get the better of me.
Right.
I'm not going to let anyone control me the way my mother controlled my dad, or my dad controlled my mother, or something like that. So often what happens is that gets built into you.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get older, it's kind of the, what I call the Scarlett O'Hara, I'm never going to go hungry again approach to life.
Right.
You know, I was powerless watching it growing up, and I'm not going to let it happen to me in my adult life.
So interesting, because something happened this morning that I would love your analysis about. I take my dog on a hike, and you're supposed to keep your dog on a leash. And
My dog just stops every 2 seconds and it drives me crazy. So I just put him off leash. He's the nicest dog. He's not going to do anything. And oftentimes they have rangers that will come around and give you like $250 tickets, but I'm willing to risk it. It's fine. I'm okay with it. So this woman comes down and she looks at me and she said, you know, what you're doing is against the law. And I said, yeah, I said, you know, I have to be honest. I said, my dog keeps stopping every 5 seconds. You know, she wasn't a ranger. She was just doing the hike. I said, oh, it's just really frustrating. And she said, well, then you need to take him to like an open dog park or something like that. And I said, oh, well, you know, he's okay or something like that. I'm like, and she said, you're not listening to me. She said, what you're doing is against the law. And I was like, I was just really surprised that someone had so much passion about this. Yeah. Like, I mean, and so I said, why does it matter to you? And she got really mad and she said, because I got bit by a dog last time who wasn't on leash. And so like for me it was like, okay, here's a woman who experienced a trauma that, you know, so deep down she's fearful. She's really fearful and that's where it's stemming from. But I'm curious sort of like your analysis about that, and because, you know, I don't know, it's just sort of surprising for someone to be that mean and sort of angry and upset and, you know, that kind of thing.
So let me ask you, when she said she got bit, did that lessen some of your anger at her when she said she got bit prior?
Well, it was
was your amygdala already hijacking you?
I think the way she said it was like she was angry at me, almost as if my dog had bit her. You know, it wasn't like, oh, you know, well, I had gotten bit here. And then I think I might have had some sensitivity, but she sort of like was really reacting to me, almost like, well, I got bit, you know, sort of like it was my fault. And so at that point, I didn't have as much sensitivity, I think, if she did say it in a nicer tone to me.
Yeah, so no, but what happened is because she said it in the tone she did, going back to tone, you had an amygdala hijack. So what happened is you immediately got reactive, you got defensive.
Uh-huh.
And then she gave an explanation, but you, by that point, you had reached the unforgiving. I don't care what she tells me, she's ticked me off.
Interesting.
And so it was tough for you to get the cow back in the barn there.
Uh-huh.
But if you had your if you had all your faculties together when she said that, you could have actually turned her into a fan. If you had said to her instead, I'll bet when that dog bit you, it scared the hell out of you.
Yeah.
And you know, and every time you see a dog who's not on a leash, it just reminds you of that. And I'll bet it might have even been terrifying for you to go through that. And this is sort of reminding you of that. Is any of that true? So sometimes when you can lean in and validate it, it's amazing how you turn raving, ranting critics into raving fans.
This is so interesting for me to hear your point of view on this, Kelly, and yours, Dr. Mark, because what's fascinating is I've happened to know Kelly for a long time, and I know what a compassionate and genuinely caring and loving person that she is. So it's interesting for me to hear that you had this sort of incensed reaction to a woman who was basically expressing that she's been traumatized and fear-based around dogs, and having taken care of my daughter's dog at times, Missy, who is Labrador Retriever, she's like a little wild puppy, even though she's 11 years old, but she doesn't like to be on leash either. But the one time I took her out and she charged these other people, all she was doing was charging them to go play, not to do anything mean. And I saw the look on this little boy's face, and the dad stepped in front and screamed at me like you cannot even imagine, made me feel this small, you know, like a pin, and he was right. I mean, this dog. Now your dog wasn't charging, but it's interesting because I bet if I had told you a story about having been bit by a dog in your office, and saying how this other person was sort of like flippantly not putting a leash on the dog, you would totally empathize.
Yes. Well, what
added to this thing? What added to the drama of this particular event is, and probably brought out the less than compassionate part of you, is you love your dog, but you are really ticked off at your dog that the dog won't, you know, when you go on a hike,
makes
it difficult.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
That would make it so much more inconvenient for you.
Yes.
So this lady was calling you out on, I don't care about your convenience factor.
That's such a
good
point.
You have to care about safety factor.
You're so right, because it was driving me a little bit bananas. Like, he wouldn't stop sniffing. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I'll just take off the leash, you know. But that's really interesting. But I guess, I don't know. I'm wondering if I could replay it. I'm wondering if she would have said to me, starting out extremely calm, like, hey, listen, you know, I got bit by a dog. I'm wondering, you know, if you could, I don't know if you realize, but it's against the law, if you could please put your leash on the dog. I think I'd
but
be much
think
more.
I don't think she could have, because if she was traumatized by being bit by a dog, then her amygdala had hijacked her on just
That's
the
right.
sight
she was,
of your dog.
She was re-traumatized.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So interesting.
You know, something I talk about, which actually, you know, neither of you will like, I don't even like it, but this is one of the tips in my book, that, that one of the ways to build emotional resilience inside ourselves is, first of all, identify when you're getting tweaked, and then say to yourself in your head, opportunity for poise.
Mm. Oh, I like that, actually.
The poise is so rare in the world, and the way you build the poise muscle is when something triggers you and you handle it with class.
Yes.
And so when I've said this to patients or clients, I say, you can swear at me in your head and say, I don't want to do opportunity for poise right now, Dr. Girlfriend. I don't want to do that. I want to do such and such. Yell at me, rant and rave, but still, it's an opportunity for poise, and handle it like that.
Yes.
And so, because when you do handle it with poise afterwards, you actually feel much better about yourself. You actually are able to say to yourself, that was classy. That was amazing self-control. Give yourself a silver star.
Do you know what one of my favorite moments in my life was? I worked with this woman for about, on and off, for about 10 years.
Uh-huh.
And she had a lot of trauma, and she would sometimes get very angry and stuff. And when she was terminating with our therapy, she said, "So the one thing that I'll always remember you for is how much grace you had in every moment of our work together." And I started to cry because it was like, wow.
So sweet.
Such, and that sounds sort of like poise.
Yes.
It, just, it made me feel so.
Exactly.
So nice.
Oh, grace is better than poise.
Oh,
yes.
Well, there you go. But it really meant a lot to me. It was something that was really, really, it's like one of those indelible moments that
I
you
love
just
that.
Remember forever.
Such a gift when you say those things to people. It really is.
Yeah, yeah. Dr. Mark, we are running out of time.
Yes. Well, do you have any last minute sort of tips or anything else you want to say about the book? And again, we're talking with Dr. Mark Goulston, Talking to Crazy. So yeah,
no, we're not talking to crazy, Dr. Mark Goulston.
The book is Talking to Crazy.
Well, my wife might disagree. In fact, 2 years ago, I said to her, you know, if I wasn't married to you, I'd be on lithium.
Oh.
And she said high, and she said high doses.
And I
said,
I love her.
I said, but the lithium wouldn't take a tone with me.
That is so cute. Adorable. Oh my gosh! How long have you guys been married?
Well, people can reach me at Mark Goulston, MarkGoulston. I have a site, markgoulston.com. But I think a good takeaway is the opportunity for poise. If you can, and also. Identify ahead of time those opportunities. So here's another tip it's kind of a twofer. If you do this, you'll not only develop poise, but you'll be able to stay on a diet longer and be able to. What I've discovered in my work is that people often go off diets after they've had a close encounter of the worst kind. So after you've dealt with someone who drives you crazy, it's very difficult to stay in a diet or exercise.
Sure.
Because you don't want to do that. So what you do is you take out a sheet of paper, put a line down the middle, and list all the people on the left side that suck the life out of you. You just hear their voice, and there's a lump in your chest or your throat.
Okay.
And on the right side, put down all the people that you love talking to, and afterwards you say to yourself, we got to do this more often. Like, you have to have me on the show more often. This is ridiculous. So And then what happens is make sure you always thank the people on the right side, because sometimes we're so frustrated with the people on the left side that we fail to thank the people on the right side, and make a commitment to minimize your contact with people on the left side, or check out my book, because there's all kinds of tips that you can use to be more effective with people on the left side. And what will happen is you'll be able to stay on a diet or exercise routine longer, and you'll feel better about yourself.
I love it. Again, thank you, Dr. Mark Goulston, author of Talking to Crazy, How to Deal with the Irrational and Impossible People in Your Life. And
thank you
can
so
find
much.
Him at Mark Goulston, drmarkgoulston.com.
No, at markgoulston.com, markgoulston.com. And I apologize for, this being on a mobile. We'll do it differently next time.
We'll do it in person next
time.
Thank you so much.
And next week, we have Abby Pecorello. I love that last name.
I know.
And it's the creator of GoNoodle.com.
I can't wait to hear about that.
Yes.
So thank you, everybody. And thanks to Kim Gold being our sponsor for the show. And we can't wait till next week.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.